I'm Matt Godbolt.
And I'm Ben Rady.
And this is To's Compliment, a programming podcast. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Matt.
We haven't really thought about this, have we?
No, I mean, not really.
We just said, hey, let's talk about technical debt. And then yeah. I said, hey, Ben, and that's as far as we've got.
That's the extent of the planning.
Of the planning. So let's talk about technical debt.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you may know that this is a little bit, it's not hard to get me on a soapbox, as our listener is well familiar with at this point. And this is one of those things that I am very happy to soapbox about, which is a new verb that I invented just now.
To soapbox. Yes. I could get behind that.
Excuse me while I soapbox. Because I think it is a metaphor, and it is something that has people have lost what the original intent of this metaphor was, what the original meaning of the metaphor was, and it has become a thing that it was never intended to be. And I think it's a harmful thing in its current sort of colloquial understanding of what it means.
Well, so why don't you define technical debt from the point of view of the original idea? Where does the term come from?
Right. Well, the good news is that I don't actually have to define it, because Ward Cunningham is the guy that invented the term, and he defined it, and we can link a video, a YouTube video in the show notes, to Ward's definition.
Right.
He explains what it is.
What's the TLDR of that, then?
Yeah, so I'm not gonna recount the entire video here in the podcast for copyright reasons, if nothing else. But the idea behind the technical debt metaphor was Ward was trying to explain to people who were not programmers that their mental model of a software system would change over time. Their understanding of a problem would change over time, and you know, they would design a system for the problem as they understood it, and then that understanding would change, and then they would have to make changes to the design in order to accommodate that new understanding. And the difference between the current state of the system and sort of like the design as it would reflect their current understanding of the problem, he referred to as debt, as technical debt, and he wanted to use that metaphor as a way to tell people, it's like the longer that we put this off, the more expensive it gets, right? Like, we have to bring the state of the design of the system up to our current understanding of the problem. Otherwise, it's just going to get more and more expensive.
And that is quite different from the way that certainly I colloquially use the term technical debt.
Right. And in this video, actually, Ward is very explicit to say, at no point did I imply or recommend that anyone write bad code and then go fix it later, right?
Right.
That's not what the metaphor was intended to describe. I don't think you can go faster by writing a bunch of bad code and then fixing it later. I think that's a slow way to program. This was about evolving a design as your understanding of the problem evolves. And if you don't, put in the time and effort to evolve that design, then the cost to change your system is going to get more and more and more and more, like interest payments on a debt, right?
Right.
I think one of the reasons why Ward's original definition got lost is that very few people actually design their software that way.
Right.
Very few people are actually, we were talking in a prior episode about incremental.
I was going to say, it seems to sound very, yeah, on theme for that.
Yes, iterative, right? Like, oh, we're gonna design it the best way that we know, and then we're going to learn more, and then we're going to redesign it, and then we're going to evolve the design. We're going to use refactoring and change the design. That's a skill. It's a skill that not a lot of people have, and even the ones that have it don't necessarily use it all the time. And so, like, I think the Ward's original definition is actually much more narrow in its applicability than the term is used. The term is used all the time for basically as a metaphor for, it's not a metaphor, it's just like, that's bad code, right? When people say technical debt, they just mean bad code. And they're not particularly specific about what they mean when they say that it's bad. And I think some of that is maybe hidden by the metaphor, which we can talk about. But I think that's sort of like what the original definition was. I think that is Ward's original definition is a very useful definition. I think it's a little bit more narrow in scope.
Very much so, yeah.
And it's something that I, you know, it sort of like makes me wince every time I see someone use it as basically a synonym for that. Well, that's code. The code is bad, and I don't like it.
Right, and I think that's the thing that you were saying like prior to us recording that is, as you say, it makes you wince. It's when people start like building around something and saying this is technical debt, and they're sort of poking it with the barge pole further and further away from them, and then saying like, well, we don't go there because it's, you know, it's full of technical debt. And it either gives you an excuse to ignore problems, or it gives you an excuse to write even worse code to keep dogpiling on, because you're like, well, it's just more what's more debt? You know, it's like you've already essentially technically bankrupt yourself, and the interest, you can't keep up the interest payments, so you're like, why even bother trying? You know, we were just another hack on a hack. That, at least from, again, that's the colloquial understanding of technical debt here, which is not what you've just described Ward's
right, absolutely. And I think another problem with this is that, you know, and I don't know, I doubt very seriously that Ward anticipated all of the impacts of him just sort of coming up with this idea. But one of the unfortunate negative impacts, I think, of this is that to most people who run businesses, debt is not a bad thing. Debt is a great tool, right? You take on debt for lots of good reasons.
Right.
So it's like, yeah, okay,
advisedly.
Cool. We'll
take on
some
debt. Advisedly.
Right.
Yeah.
Even if it's sometimes kind of high interest, like, you know, if you're starting a new venture and you need to move quickly, it's like, yeah, we'll take on a bunch of debt. Like, that's fine. So like, you know, the way that people, you blend those two ideas together, right?
Mm-hmm.
The misunderstanding of technical debt as bad code and the sort of financial application of debt as a useful tool, you wind up with this weird intersection, which is bad code is a good, useful tool. Right?
Yeah,
which,
right.
At no point does anyone who created this term even coming close to implying, right?
Right,
so it's
right.
Sort of like becomes this like received wisdom of technical debt. Received from who? With what purpose? Right?
Right.
It's the worst sort of argument from authority where you didn't even understand the original argument from authority.
Right. It's completely. There's not even like a coherent thought process behind it because it's a phantom
right.
idea. No one actually made this point. It was
right,
yeah.
right.
But I guess it's entered the zeitgeist of programmers, mm-hmm. right?
Yes, it has.
So we're kind of stuck with it, whether Ward meant it to mean this or not. When people colloquially, like 9 times out of 10, if I'm talking to someone else, I'll be honest with you, I'll be making you wince by saying, you know, hey, we've got that error. Like, you know, I'm working on something right now. There are like 2,000 parallel pieces of work that I'm doing across a multitude of days. There's all sorts of broken bits of data and things that I'm having to deal with. And if one or two of those things fail, I'm like kind of okay with it right now, because on aggregate, that's still useful for me. Mm-hmm. And in my mind's eye, I'm like, I want to chase down every single thing. I need to understand it. For all I know, the reason that day one dies, you know, crashes out, is actually a systemic problem through the whole code base, right? And then it's just that it doesn't crash on the other days or whatever. But in order to move forward quickly, I am, in my mind, I'm filing that under technical debt incorrectly and saying, I'm going to move on and we'll come back to it a bit later. Because, I mean, and maybe you could argue this is part of the, and I'm going to try and swing it as part of the progressive, I can't remember what we came up with, iterative way.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to get to the end. I want to get my 2,000 days, broken or not broken, and then say, well, the next stage of the pipeline is to do this thing. And I think it's this, but I don't know that it's this. As in, mm-hmm. I don't even know what the design should be or what the facilities I need to produce are. So I'd rather get there with some amount of like brokenness mm-hmm. to explore the space, solution space of the next part, and then adds actually two more steps after that. I'd rather get all the way and then go back to the beginning and go like, okay, these things need to be looked at now. These warnings that we're seeing, or these crashes we're seeing, are a symptom of, in my mind, the technical debt that I'm paying down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's so easy to go like, oh yeah, it's just bad code. I don't think my code is bad. It's just these are bugs. These are issues that I've got tracked in GitHub or whatever, and
yeah.
I know I'm going to come back to them. They're just not high priority right now, but they could be something that actually is really important to look down. Like, for example, I'm going to give you an example that's literally just happened right now.
Yeah, yeah.
We had an issue with a timestamp that fast-forwarded itself into the future. It was like 150 years in the future. Suddenly we know we're processing data from 2022, and then suddenly it's the year 2187. And you're like, oh my gosh, what the heck's happened here? I had seen it once, and I'd filed a bug, and I couldn't reproduce it, and I let it sit. Now, obviously, that's kind of like there's something wrong in the system. Everyone knows mm-hmm. there's something wrong in the system. Mm-hmm. Was it a corrupt file for one day ever? Who knows, right? I certainly didn't at that point in time. And then we let it lie. You know, it happened again one more time. We put added something to it, but no one really tracked it down. And then today we had a completely unconnected issue where we ran out of disk space. And the mm-hmm. reason it turns out, now we know, that we ran out of disk space is that some poor process was trying to fill in all of the gaps between 2018 and 2187 with just empty data, because it's like, oh, well, you know, mm-hmm. I have to do like a forward fill of all of this data, and it ran out of disk space doing so, understandably. And of course, then we're like, oh, wait a second, where have I seen the year 21? Oh, I know, this is that bug. And all this time, that has been sat there, and actually, we've processed other data incorrectly, so we found the problem, we fixed it, and now we're cursed to actually go back and reconvert a whole bunch of data, which is, you know, expensive. So mm-hmm, mm-hmm. that did not pay off. That came back to haunt me. But sometimes it doesn't, right? And am I right to, you know, stop and drop and do everything every time? I don't know. No.
And so here's the thing about this is that the reason I wince is not because I'm trying to advocate that everyone should do everything perfectly all the time for some definition of perfectly. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is that why are we using this broken, misaligned metaphor to talk about things that we as programmers can be much more specific about and have much more precise terminology about? Because when I hear you say this is technical debt, that doesn't really align with the other things that I see people call technical debt. Because at least in my mind, those are very different things with very different impacts on the system and the reliability of the system and the long-term viability and the product, everything else. And so the ways that I kind of, the dimensions that I think about when it comes to these sorts of things, and this is something that has definitely been evolving in my mind over the last few years. You know, this is not like some, you know, received wisdom. Everybody knows this has been around a long time. I've been trying to like say, okay, Ben, well, if technical debt is not the right way to think about it, then what is? And the more modern thinking that I have on this is that you should think of your system in terms of complexity, its capabilities, and its risks. And so what I hear you describing here is actually just a risk. There's a mm-hmm. risk in the system that is unaddressed.
Yep.
And it can make very good sense not to address all of your risks. I mean, this is true in every endeavor of engineering, right? They don't bridges that are like impossible to fall over because they would be cost prohibitive, right? There's a certain standard that they design to, and they say that it is, you know, it's going to fail under these conditions, or it's going to fail after this amount of time if it hasn't been maintained. And there are, you know, risks that you carry in the operation and the construction of that bridge, and those are deemed to be acceptable for whatever application it is that you're doing. And it's no different in software, right? So mm-hmm. you have risks that are in your system, and it is right and proper for you to make a backlog of those risks and account for them. But it's not necessarily right to just always fix all of them as soon as you possibly can.
Right.
Right? So that's one dimension, right? Yeah, and that is a very different thing than technical debt. Lumped in to, talk about this metaphor of technical debt, and it means basically bad code. And what it means is, oh, it's a risk that we have. You know, if the disk fills up, if this problem occurs, if we see this exception we've never seen before, whatever, right? So that's one thing.
Yeah.
Another thing is capabilities, just new features, new functionality. Now, I've definitely used the term capabilities more and more working where I do, because features mean something totally different.
I mean, features means about three different things to three people within our organization.
Right.
So yeah, capabilities and facilities and whatever. We all come up with like alternative
functionality.
Similarly, for what it's worth, we always talk about, you know, if you talk about the if you sort an array of things, they are ordered. But if we talk about, you know, the ordering or the order, or, you know, what order are they in? Again, in our world, order means something else. There's an order. Yeah,
right.
So I always say sequence now. Are they sequenced in this way? Are they, you know?
Yeah,
so you kind of learn these ways of avoiding ambiguity in your day to day based on the sort of colloquial expressions that are more common than the perhaps, more common in general English ways. Yeah, anyway.
Right, right.
So anyway, I mean, the facilities.
Yes.
Facilities, no, capabilities.
The capabilities, right. It's the things that your software is capable of doing.
Yeah.
Right? And you're going to have gaps in those capabilities. Sometimes those gaps actually represent risks, like, oh, if this thing happens, then we won't handle it and it'll crash.
Yeah.
Sometimes the gaps in the capability are just like, yeah, we just don't do that yet, right? That's not something that the system does for you, right?
Literally, before coming, you know, I know we said about this bug we found, but I was adding the capability of our cache directory to have a maximum size, which at the moment it doesn't. And we've been working around it by every now and then you just rm-rf /temp/, you know, my cache, whatever. And we're like, we've kind of been fine with that. That's a capability we could live without, but it's annoying. Mm-hmm. And now you can, I'm like, well, we can add that capability. So that's fine. And yeah, all right, okay. Capabilities.
Mm-hmm. And then the third thing is complexity. Now, I think we've talked before in the show about complexity, necessary complexity versus unnecessary complexity. I think it's good to minimize unnecessary complexity, but I think the thing that you really just sort of want to be looking at is the total complexity. Whether it's necessary, whether it's unnecessary, it's still there. It still makes your code harder to understand, harder to change.
Right.
It doesn't really matter if it's perfectly designed and is the absolute minimum thing that it could possibly be. It's still complex.
Yeah.
That still has costs, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And so these are the three dimensions of software that I kind of think about, and I try to, whenever I think about technical debt, I try to think about, okay, is this a risk? Is this missing capabilities? Is this complexity? Like, what is this more specifically? I don't need to use a metaphor, a financial metaphor, to reason about this. I'm a programmer. I'm talking to other programmers. I can be more concrete.
You can
right?
say these things. Yeah. And you're right. A lot of those things. So what I'm hearing from you is that some of the, I mean, because we can make up a straw definition of what other people think technical debt is in a second, because I think that'll be useful. But right, what you're now is saying is like within at least the people we talk to, when people say technical debt, they're probably better served by thinking of it in one of those three categories, because we're assuming they don't mean my code is just terrible and that's okay, which is the other, again, now this is the straw man.
Well, I would put that in unnecessary complexity. Right.
You're right. I mean, I could make an argument that just complexity of its own is not necessary. You know, there is, while bad code can be unnecessarily complicated, it can also just be simple and bad and wrong.
Well, yeah.
You know,
okay.
Sometimes you have to add complexity to make it better. You know, like, hey, I've got this really simple bash script. And this bash script is, you know, and you're like, but that's, why are you doing it in bash? You're like, well, it's because it's three lines of bash. And you're like, but if there's no monitoring, there's no email if it goes down, that I can't parallelize it. All these things, I guess those are capabilities and things like that. But it's not bad. I don't know. Yeah, you're right. Now listener, Ben is grinning the I told you so grin at me right now.
Well, I mean, I'm bringing all these things up. Again, this is something that I have been thinking about for a while, and I don't know that, I'm not trying to actually say that this is some new comprehensive way to think about it. I'm trying to figure out a replacement. Like, I
for
know
it,
that
right.
technical debt is wrong. And I keep thinking about, like, okay, how can I be more precise about this, right?
I mean, first of all, we should note that Perry has just made his first podcast appearance.
Oh, has he?
Yeah, he's behind you right now. So Ben's dog came in. I'm sure I saw it. I did not invent that. Maybe he left again.
Did he walk back out again?
I didn't notice him go out, but I thought, I was like, hey, it's Perry.
Yeah.
You know, we've had Monty make a debut, although he's asleep behind me.
He's under the desk.
Is he not? No, all right. Now I've just made you look around.
He's probably somewhere in here. I don't know.
Anyway, I've now forgot what we were talking about.
Well, it's you know, I'm trying to find new tests for my scientific theory here, right?
All right.
My hypothesis is that you can categorize, you can take what currently falls into the very vague category of technical debt, and actually a little bit broader than that, the sort of like the aspects of software that you need to care about when you think about technical debt and like good code versus bad code and things like that,
fit
them into one of three categories. Is it a risk? Is it a capability? Or is it complexity? And complexity has a necessary and an unnecessary component to it, right?
Got it.
And I will say that, like, for me, on the projects that I'm working on right now, these things are actually fairly directly measurable, right? If you want to see my risks, go look in the issue backlog. All the risks that we know about are in there, right?
Yeah.
If you want to see the current implemented capabilities, look at the tests. All the tests describe all the capabilities of the system, and you can see what they all are, right? If you want to know the missing capabilities, well, that's probably also in the issue
backlog. In the issue tracker, yeah.
And if you want to know what the complexity is, you can do a lot worse than just counting the number of lines of code. Like, there are other more sophisticated ways to measure complexity
in
code.
But it's not a bad proxy.
It's not a bad measurement of complexity, right?
Yeah, yeah, fair.
And so that's sort of the way that I think about it. We think about, like, we could mitigate this risk, mm-hmm. but is it worth the complexity?
Yeah.
Right? Maybe it's better just to wear the risk. And, like, even if it happens once, it's like, yeah, you know, it crashed. We turned it back on again. Wasn't great.
Yeah, this is a bit like that sort of pragmatic thing where if you can't write a test for it, make it fail fast. You know, like there's a trade-off there. It's like I could spend a ton of complexity testing every command line parameter to my command line tool, mm-hmm. or the first time anyone notices that dash dash whatever doesn't work anymore is like we go fix it. I mean, again, right. You don't want to. Yeah.
Right. Because I feel like unless you have those ways to discuss the trade-offs, what you wind up getting into is this sort of like semantic argument about like, oh, that's technical debt, it's terrible. And you're like, no, that's just a reasonable trade-off. And it's like, mm-hmm. what are you trading off, right? Like, if you can't describe that, if you can't enumerate that, it sort of falls into this vague definition of it's just bad and I don't like it.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And there's a lot of, we've talked about FUD sort of before, mm-hmm. about, you know, there's a lot of fear, uncertainty, doubt. You can use it as kind of like one of those words, but once you've painted it with that, it's like you know, it's just bad, unequivocally bad. Mm-hmm. But one thing that's I think missing, and maybe this is maybe you're a talk to this, but like, is there is something really emotive, which is perhaps the problem with the term technical debt, because I think everybody, even when you're talking about engineering stuff, everyone can kind of get your head around the fact that debt has a compounding aspect mm-hmm. to it, and not all of the things that you've said have a compounding aspect to them.
No, that's
right?
True. Yeah.
Missing capabilities don't necessarily have a compounding aspect. It's like, oh, I mean, they could do. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
The risks could be compounding. You could imagine a risk which is like, well, if that happens, then oh, now all these other things become really important. You know, suddenly, like, mm-hmm. you know, if you can't reproducibly recreate all your data from scratch, then this bug that you have, that you've seen once that can corrupt a file, might be very, very a big deal, because suddenly you might have to go through, you know, hundreds of thousands of terabytes of, you know, data again or whatever, right? That can compound. But almost always code complexity has a sort of in your face day on day compounding effect, where it's like, yeah, I want to add a new capability. Oh, but the code is too complex.
Right.
And it's sort of like it gets worse and worse and worse, because it's sort of like what you're really talking about is sort of entropy of the code base, mm-hmm. and it just gets worse on its own somehow, right? You could go back to a project from 2 years ago and somehow it's worse than you left it. You know, mm-hmm. bit rot is real. It feels like that there's sort of some, and again, it's emotive rather than like, you know, I can't put my finger on it. As you say, if we're talking about professionals talking to professionals, I think we all understand that is already present. If I just say, yeah, look, the code is unnecessarily complicated, you can say, yeah, I guess that makes it a pain to change. You're like, certainly does. And, you know, like that, you know, right? Well, we don't have to say, but it's a debt.
Right.
But
right.
It does. Yeah. But it's so easy. It's a trap to fall into. I mean, I can.
It is a trap to fall into. And I think if you go back to Ward's original definition and think about what he was actually talking about, he was talking about unnecessary complexity in my model. Right. Mm-hmm. He was talking about like the problem has our understanding of the problem has evolved beyond the current design. There are things in the current design that don't fit that problem. And it could be like, you know, literally just code that isn't used anymore. It could be designs that really aren't applicable for the problem that they're trying to solve. And you sort of like twist them around to try to get it to work. And it's just adding a bunch of things that you just don't need. And the solution to that, or a way to address that is maybe a better way to think about it, is to refactor the code so that the design better fits the problem that you have, and hopefully just sort of shrink the number of lines But at a minimum, just make them easier to understand, right?
Yeah.
And again, this sort of gets back to my thing of like, that is a very narrow thing. Ward was talking about a very specific type of unnecessary complexity, mm-hmm. where the design has not evolved along with the understanding of the problem. There is an opportunity to remove some unnecessary complexity, right? Very narrow. But that, I mean, you're absolutely right to hit on the fact that the complexity, period, is compounding, right? Here's a thought experiment for you. Let's say that you have a, have we done the Alice and Bob and going to the park? Have we talked about, I'm just going to say this again. Forgive me, dear listener.
If this is a repeat, it doesn't ring a bell for me, but that doesn't mean anything. I'm still mildly hungover, as you may have picked up.
Yeah, right there with you. So you have, let's say that you accidentally give, two programmers on a team the same problem on the same day, right? Alice and Bob. And,
they're not sending cryptic messages to each other example. And no one is trying to intercept it or whatever.
Nope,
but they're
nope,
just
nope.
two regular
just two
programmers on your team. And you
trying
say,
to solve
hey.
A problem. And they accidentally are both trying to solve the same problem at the same time, not
Got
knowing
it.
That the other person is working on it. And so Bob sits down and he writes 1,000 lines of code to solve this problem. And this code is perfectly designed. It is as simple as it could possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
It is well tested. It is well designed. It is correctly documented. So whatever level of documentation is appropriate for this project,
right.
please apply that level of documentation. and it solves the problem perfectly. And he spends all day on working that. At the end of the day, he pushes his changes into a PR and sends the PR to Alice saying, like, hey, can you please review this? And then
meanwhile,
while all this is going on, Alice goes to the park, and she sits in the park, and she feeds the pigeons, and she thinks about the problem. And she sits there all day, feeding the pigeons and thinking about the problem. And she comes back to the office at like 4:30, and she deletes 3 lines of code and pushes a PR, fixing the same problem that Bob fixed. Which of those two solutions is better?
I mean, the one that involves sitting in the park is better just,
Obviously, Alice's solution is better, right?
Yeah.
There's unnecessary complexity in Bob's solution. None. Other than the fact that he just wasn't really solving the right problem. He didn't understand that the way to fix this is to just not do these 3 things
instead
of accounting for...
And I think we can all think of things that fall into that kind of category of like, this is a perfect solution to... So, for example, we just talked about this, like the cache that I'm talking about here is a big cache for these giant files that I download from wherever, whatever. And the 3-line fix, really, if I had access to the code that I needed, would be just read the files directly from the network appliance. Don't download them to the cache and then manage the cache. And so like here I am, I'm adding complexity here to deal with the problem that I've created myself. Whereas if somebody was smarter than me and could work out how to get... you're with me. You're with me on this, and it's. I like to think of this as the old lady who swallowed a fly. You know the children's rhyme.
Yeah,
and she swallowed a fly. Perhaps she'll die, and then she swallows a spider to catch the fly. And we've all written spider level fixes for something, right? Like there's this thing I didn't think about it, but I can solve it by swallowing a spider, and then. The tale continues until she's swallowing a horse, and I think at that point, you should be fired. Actually, if you're considering swallowing a horse, but it takes there's a lot of inertia because there's a lot of code that's written in the horse, the cow, the dog, the cat. I'm trying to remember now, the cat, the frog, the spider. I don't know, whatever it was that she swallowed to swallow the fly. And then what you really want to do is go back and say, back in time, as we can as developers, and say, let's just not swallow the fly in the first place.
Right.
And now we're good.
Right.
And that's
right.
Alice there.
Or, and getting back to my sort of Alice Bob hypothetical scenario, one way that could very practically play out is what Alice was thinking about in the park is it really bad if we swallow a fly? Because maybe we could avoid this whole thing by just taking on a very small risk that is a completely acceptable risk and is totally better than another 1,000 lines of code.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to go delete these 3 lines, and there's a chance we'll swallow a fly, and turns out that's just a little bit extra protein, and we'll all be fine.
Yeah, maybe that's... Yeah, so that's an even better analogy then. Sometimes it doesn't... Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, just deal with it. You swallowed a fly. All right.
Yeah.
Restart the server once it's every fine. 3 months or whatever, rather than the, well, we've got this thing that follows this, you know, that you've seen like the sipping bird. You know those sipping bird things that, like, you kind of heat up and then they kind of like keep dipping forward? There was, I think it was at Google, a whole thing with that, which was the thing at the very end of the chain that kind of like causes everything to continue running, is the sipping bird that's hitting like the space bar on the computer console. That's like, yeah, carry on, whatever. It doesn't matter. Just, you know, somewhere along the line of complexity, this Rube Goldberg machine that you've built, you're like, something has to be physically at the server pressing the button. And yeah, you could do worse than a little sipping bird. Now that we've gone all over the place with that, but yeah, that's a really powerful thought, is that like the fact that you could be trading a very small risk for a ton of complexity, and say, I'm taking on this very small risk and I'm fine with it, actually.
Yeah,
it's all right. Yeah. You know what? I'm not going to worry about what happens if you run out of disk space, and all the cleanup code that might go with it. I'm just like, well, if it happens, we'll get paged. That's fine. Or that particular process will die. The machine will get recycled. A new one will come up and we'll go and look for why that happened. But we don't have to have proactive, like, cash, whatever, you know, just again, top of mind for me. So I'm going to keep drawing on what I've been doing the last couple of hours. No, that's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing that you can do with this, we were talking about trading off, like, how do you get rid of complexity, right? This is the thing that feeds on itself. This is the thing that makes it harder and harder to add stuff. Yes, we want to eliminate accidental complexity, what a lot of people would say is technical debt, what Ward was talking about with that very narrow definition there.
Okay.
Yes, we want to get rid of that. But sometimes the only way to make this better is to get rid of essential complexity, and that's by changing the problem.
Hmm.
Everyone has seen like the Kanban board or the task board or the Jira, whatever. Here's all the 75 things that we need to do, right? What percentage of those things are remove this feature?
Yeah, that's never
It's never on that board.
Very rarely.
Very, very rarely.
I have one right now, but it's mostly we migrated a system and then we should get rid of the old system. And you know how long that has been kicked down the can? About 3 months now.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, it's not still not really important enough to get rid of, even though.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Or maybe even more so. Here are all the features that are not carrying their complexity weight. They're useful. They're valuable to somebody, but we've decided that, you know what, the 10,000 lines of code that we have in our system that supports this one feature that is not worth it is going to be removed. And there's been the, you know, conversation with the group or the person, whoever it is, that likes this thing. It's like, I'm sorry, I know you like this. Here's this alternative that we wrote for you in 12 lines of Bash. Right? It's not as good, but it does the job.
But it does the job, and more importantly,
it will save us this giant chunk of complexity
headache.
That, I mean, you know, a not totally off way to think about these kinds of things in terms of managing complexity is, again, regardless of whether it's accidental or essential or whatever, is imagine if every time you want to add a line of code to your system, you had to read log base 10 of the lines in your system, right? So you can very easily and quickly see how you're going to get slower and slower and slower and slower the more stuff that you add.
So
thinking about how you're going to manage that complexity and thinking about what tools you have in your arsenal for getting rid of it. Obviously, getting rid of accidental complexity, great. If you find it, get rid of it. You find code that you don't need anymore, delete it. You find things that are too complicated, can be simplified, great, do that. But you have more tools than that, right? And you need to use them, because if you don't, what will eventually happen is your system will turn into a haunted graveyard. It will turn into the thing that everyone is scared to touch. Like, oh, don't go there. Every time you make a change to that thing, it breaks because nobody understands how it works anymore.
Right.
And then people are like, well, we just need to rewrite it, right? And then you rewrite it, and then the cycle begins anew.
Like,
and you have a whole
Phoenix
a new team
from the ashes
comes in.
Of the previous system with all
exactly.
the same flaws,
I mean,
right?
How, dear listener, how many times have you seen in your career the phenomena of the old system that has turned into the haunted graveyard that nobody wants to touch, and then they bring in a new person to maintain it, or maybe a whole team, and they look at it for a few months and are like, the solution here is a rewrite. We're going to rebuild it.
Yeah.
And then they rebuild it, and then 5 years later, the exact same thing has occurred.
I can
right?
think. Yeah. We turned that around. We One of the things that I've seen happen a number of times is that if you've got a facility that is sort of not exactly required, you know, maybe it's a visualization tool or a monitoring tool, or in our case, a simulator for something, then that's when the, you know, junior folks come in and you say, hey, we're going to rewrite it again. And you get to do it as a way of learning how we do software development here, or we're going to write it in a new language that we're just trying out here. And if it, you know, we know that we're going to rewrite it again in another year's time because we always do. So at least in that way, you're kind of capitalizing on the idea that this thing is essentially permanently cursed.
Right. Yes.
It's a haunted house on purpose, right? You know.
It's like the Halloween haunted house where you go there and it's just a fun time.
Oh, it's meant to be like this. I see. Yeah. Okay, right. You know, we wrote it in, you know, Scala. Have we got anything else written in Scala? No, it was just seemed like a fun thing to do, and we're going to rewrite it again anyway. So,
gosh, Scala, that is scary.
Let's not offend anyone who. but yeah, no, it's true that certainly. Larger code bases in particular suffer from this, or larger areas, especially when you mentioned something about like, hey, is this code even used, or is it used by one thing once, or is there a test? You know, we've all seen code bases that grow and grow and grow, and nobody has culled out the stuff that isn't used. And if you're not careful, you find that if you're very lucky, you find the only use is the test that tests the functionality. And then you ask yourself, well, it apparently is used, but it's used by a test. Anyone other than the test use it? No. Do we really need it? Because it is a bit of a millstone. Now, with all the automatic refactoring tools that we've got, it's a little bit easier to carry around unused code, a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. But in the old days, should we say, of like greps and finds and replaces, the more chances of hitting things that you don't need, the larger your code base with unnecessary mentions of things that maybe or may sound like the thing that you're trying to change, the more likely you are to get like collateral damage of hitting, you know, your regex renames the wrong variable or whatever, or you forget to update one case of it or any of things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think even with the refactoring tools, there's a cost there because the tree of dependencies isn't shaped the way that you want. If you've got some piece of code that's unused, so nothing calls it, right? It can still call lots of other things.
Yeah,
and by doing
that's
so, it puts a constraint on what those things can be.
Yeah, okay, that's fair.
Right? Yeah. I mean, how many times have you had this thing where you're sort of like, well, I really want to change this return type, but if I do, it's going to screw. So what calls that? What calls that? What calls? Nothing! Nothing calls this! This whole chain is, why have I spent the last half an hour looking through this code? Right? I could have just changed it as soon as I saw it, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So, that unused code, and I mean, you know, you say it's sort of like, you know, do we need to keep it? It's like, well, you've already kept it. If you're looking at it, there's a very good chance it's in your source control.
And then you can go and get it. But
actually quite difficult to remove from the source control. So,
But then, you know, the counter to that, and this is a weak counter, I think, just thinking out loud, really. The counter to that is that if it is in source control, it is stagnant.
Yeah,
if you come
true.
Back to it that like 3 months later and go, didn't we have a thing that did the other stuff? And then you find that it doesn't work anymore. But then what you're trading off is the cost of the incrementally keeping a piece of code up to date and the transitive closure of things that use it or have been used by it.
Right.
That maybe is like a null set or maybe is a large set of things, but they're just inconsequential and they actually hurt you, right? But that's one cost. Against the speculative cost of if we were to remove it and then have to resurrect it, talking of haunted graveyards and things again, right?
Yep.
If you do need to resurrect this piece of code and functionality, you might have to do a little bit of surgery there and then. And that seems often like that might not be as bad as it sounds. Now, obviously, if everything's changed under your feet, it's no longer version 7 of this library, is now version 94, and the whole API is gone and you don't know what you're doing with it anymore, but maybe... Yeah, it's very subjective, I guess. It depends on the thing. But like, again, this is a risk or a trade-off that we're talking about at the beginning of this. Like, what's the risk? If I take this out, there is a risk that we may need it in future. And you could actually say, I'm removing this capability.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And trading off for the risk that we might need it again in some indeterminate amount of time. And maybe I can wear that risk. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, I have removed some essential complexity, because it's essential because it supports a capability that we say that we needed.
Yeah.
But I'm trading it off a risk. Yeah.
And I think there's another bet that you're making there when you keep that code because you think you might need it one day, which is your option is delete it and recover it from source control at some point in the future when you decide you need it again.
Mm-hmm.
Or keep it and pay the cost to maintain it through all the transitions of all the other code between now and then, right?
Yep.
It is entirely possible that the work to reincorporate it in the future will be smaller than each individual change that you have to make.
The integral of the area
right.
under the graph.
Because you might change it one way and then change it back the other way and then change it one way and then change it back the other way. And if you could just hop from the beginning to the end, it would actually be way cheaper, right?
Yeah.
And it's hard to say. And so, like, you know, for me personally, if there's code in the code base that isn't used, unless I, like, know, like, I'm working on this next week. I'm going to add this capability in next, tomorrow, the day after, right? Like, it's going to be there, like, it's the next thing in my list, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right. Simon.
Unless it's something like that, I'm going to delete it every time. Because I know it's in source control, I'll know I'll bring it back. There's a very good chance that when I bring it back, it'll actually be easier to reintegrate. Mm-hmm. And if nothing else, I can sort of reevaluate the capability in the context of the new design, right? Like, I can be like, okay, this is the capability I want. Here's some code that does it. Actually, now I only want these like 8 lines, and I'm going to put them over here instead of where they were before.
A step back from it, a little chance to reevaluate it in the light of new evidence instead of the incremental, like, well, I'm just keeping the test passing aspect of it that maybe you were doing before, which is not as thoughtful as intentional, you know, as the, okay, now I've got it in front of me and I can make it fit the design as it is now, as it has evolved in one step rather than the thousands of paper cuts along the way.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I don't know, but this is kind of my proposed replacement for technical debt. And this is, again, when you're talking to programmers, when programmers are talking to programmers, they don't need to use metaphors. If you want to keep using technical debt with your boss because he knows what it means and you know what it means and you have a common understanding of what it means, that's fine. I'm not telling you not to do that. But if we're talking about code, we can be more precise. We can talk about risks. We can talk about capabilities, functionality, whatever you want to call it. We can talk about complexity. I think every programmer suffers at that, right? Suffers from that.
Yeah.
And we can talk about the trade-offs between those things.
Yeah.
Right? Because sometimes those trade-offs really make sense to make.
Yeah. No, it makes a lot of sense to me. I was just about to make an argument for one of the few places where I see complexity budgets being spent in places where you wouldn't expect them to be, but it's still essential complexity, is in high-performance code. But I think that's just a capability. You know, the capability of, like, processing something in a certain amount of time. Yeah. You know, I was going to say, but performance is another category. But no, I think we can quite reasonably call it a capability, you know, or like a sort of constraint, a design constraint on the system. Mm-hmm. It must be able to do X. And you can say it must be able to do X in Y, or with latency lower than whatever. You know, we've all seen those bits of code, right? You know, the beautiful design where you've got every little object that has its own little responsibility, and then ultimately you go down and say, no, it just needs to be super quick. I'm just going to sit down and write the very complicated thing with more comment than it is code, because I'm explaining why we're not calling this whatever and we're resuming X. And then you're like, this is costly. And at the far extreme of that, actually, I was giving a chat at lunchtime a couple of weeks ago, and I was walking through some of my late 90s era Dreamcast code, which includes some Hitachi SH4 assembly code as well. And it's like, you know, like, you've seen my code, you know, that I tend not to comment that much. I rely on like useful variable names and function names and extracting. But like, when you're writing assembly, you've kind of got no choice. And so it was just awash with this prose about what I'm doing, how it's doing, why this allocation's like this, why the format's like whatever. And it was going like, why is it so well commented? And I'm like, well, because it's so complicated. And then I said, the problem with this though is that, like, if someone turns around to me and says, can you make it do X? I'll be like, no, I can't.
Yeah,
it's, you know, this is a huge deal now, and it's hard to change. And that's the complexity. Yeah. Anyway, that's a complete aside. I guess, you know, we're looking at the time. We should probably, I think we've reached a natural conclusion here. I think you've said what you need to say about this, which is that, like, technical debt is probably not what you think it is, unless you're Ward Cunningham or Ben Rady. And now maybe anyone who's listened to this podcast.
Yeah.
Maybe it's excusable to colloquially refer to kind of any naff bit of the code base for whatever reason as technical debt to non-technical folks.
Yeah.
But it's probably, no, it's not probably, it is definitely more useful to describe it in a more specific term. And when you're talking to other programmers, and it's either a risk, a capability, or complexity. And those are the things that you are knowingly trading between. And that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I like
this
that.
This is what I'm aspiring to do. I mean, I still use the term technical debt. Like, it's something where it's like I catch myself and I'm like, can you be more precise about this, Ben? Can you describe what you're trying to say better?
Is this when you have your one-on-ones with yourself?
In the shower.
That is the place where most of the real deep thinking happens, isn't it? It's like you're just the right side of wakefulness, but not yet fully booted up.
Right.
And you've not had the coffee or anything like that, and you've got no other distractions. And yeah, it's like a meditation, isn't it? That's when you really these things come out.
We're sitting in the park next to Alice.
Feeding the ducks with Alice. All right, that sounds like a perfect place for us to finish.
Cool.
See you next time.
Bye.
You've been listening to Two's Compliment, a programming podcast by Ben Rady and Matt Godbold. Find the show transcript and notes at www.twoscompliment.org. Contact us on Mastodon. We are at twoscompliment@pachyderm.io. Our theme music is by Inverse Phase. Find out more at inversephase.com.